Besides, like you said, it's for love. Love?
The word was bitter as hemlock. It's just another addiction. He sighed, but he didn't protest. We both sat under the heavy blanket of silence until a breeze stole in and rustled the pages on the walls. I stared at his stolen trinkets. Kashmir, you're a good thief.
Good at thieving? Or good and a thief?
Don't fish. We both know you're good enough to think you can steal $1 million in gold and silver.
Or foolish enough,
he grinned. So you shouldn't have any trouble with a single roll of paper?
Ah,
he said, but his smile faded.
Clever.
Of course, the captain wouldn't like it.
That depends,
he said cautiously. On?
On whether or not we succeed.
Do you doubt whether we can?
No,
he said, tilting his head.
But I do wonder why we should. I thought you were done helping him.
Well, it's less dangerous than trying to steal the gold. Kashmir let the silence stretch, studying me.
And?
He said at last. I sighed. And, if he's willing to do anything for the map, I'd rather he negotiate with us than them. He gave me an appraising look.
You do understand the law of the jungle.
Hope rose in my throat. You'll do it?
For you?
I blinked, unsure how to respond, aware of how unfair it was to ask. But Kashmir did not wait for an answer.
I'll try.
Thank you! I threw my arms around him and he laughed, or maybe it was a grunt.
Can't breathe!
Sorry. I rocked back on my heels, buzzing with energy. So, how are we going to do it?
So eager now, Miss Relative Morality.
Stealing a map versus robbing a kingdom? I'll throw myself on the mercy of the law.
Mercy? You've never really dealt with the law, have you? Ow!
He added, even though I hadn't hit him that hard.
Well,
he went on,
I don't know just yet, but I'll figure it out. And I think the best time to do that is at the ball. I heard you needed a date.
Chapter 15. I woke the next morning, with Kashmir's breath tickling my ear. We'd talked late into the night, and I had only meant to rest my eyes for a minute, but it had been so warm in the nest of silk beside him. He'd tossed his arm over me as we'd slept. In those first moments of wakefulness, I didn't have the willpower to throw it off. My eyes drifted open and focused on his hand, inches from my nose. His fingers were curved into a soft, relaxed shape as he slept. I stared at them, memorizing the lines in the skin, the rounding of the knuckles, the little white scars. A small part of me was ashamed at enjoying the closeness I never would have accepted had we both been fully awake. But I tried to ignore it, tried to let sleep steal back. Time passed as it does in a dream, until the sound of heavy footsteps on the deck above roused me. It must have been the captain, pacing by overhead toward the cabin. Or the hatch. I was bolt upright half a second before he opened the door.
Get up, Cash. It's long past...
Slate stopped on the threshold, his mouth still open. Kashmir's body went rigid, his eyes snapping open, but the captain was staring at me. With all my might, I resisted the urge to explain. I'd be damned if I'd make it his business. Slate took a deep breath, dropped his eyes, then shifted on his feet, looking everywhere but at me.
15 minutes, Kashmir.
Then he shut the door. He didn't even slam it. I laughed a little, incredulous, triumphant. But Cash clambered to his feet, his hand on his forehead. What's wrong? I asked. That could have been much worse.
It also could have been better,
he said, pulling off his shirt and throwing it into the corner. So what? He needs you.
I'm not worried about me, Cash said, rifling through his closet. I'd hate to see you in trouble.
In trouble? For this? Nothing even happened, and he has no moral high ground even if it did.
I watched Kashmir slide a shirt off a hanger, put it on, button it up. The silence felt loud.
Which it didn't.
I know. He glanced back over his shoulder and gave me a wink. I was there.
My cheeks started to burn. So where are you two going anyway?
He pinned his cuffs. I'm sure you can guess.
Creeping around the treasury?
Reconnoiter is a nicer word.
I made a face. Don't get caught. The last thing we need is for you to go to jail.
For treason? He said, running a comb through his tousled hair. We wouldn't go to jail.
Really?
We'd be shot.
You always know just what to say.
I try to look on the bright side.
He hooked his thumbs into the waistband of his pants.
Now, unless you have regrets about what didn't happen.
His laughter followed me out into the hall. My ears were still ringing with it when I got up above decks. It was a beautiful day, the blue sky paling beside the sapphire sea. Half a mile out, rollers were combing the sandbar in long lines of cloud-white foam, and past them, fishermen in canoes clustered around the coral reefs. The air was cool, and as the balmy breeze ruffled the water of the bay, the sun changed the surface of the sea into a Milky Way of sparkling stars. Bee and Rotgut were stooped over a swath of netting, making repairs. When Bee glanced up at me, Rotgut smiled hugely.
Ooh!
Bee swatted at him.
Go make lunch. It's not even mid-morning. Make something that takes a long time.
Rotgut rolled his eyes, and when he passed me on the way to the hatch, he gave me a big thumbs up. The netting was spread out on the planks under the clothesline. I was careful not to step in it.
Word travels fast, I said to Bee as I gathered my clothes.
They were warm with sunlight.
It didn't have far to go.
Bee tied off a knot.
That boy, you know he has no cattle.
So?
So I paid 13 head to marry Iron, although the price was only 10. But if you had seen her dance, oh, the way she moved.
No, I know, I said, cutting her off before she went through the entire story. But Kashmir and I are just friends. She pursed her lips at me, but I only shrugged. Besides, I'm a terrible dancer.
Maybe you should find some cattle.
Where would I even keep them?
Cattle are only a metaphorical representation of worth, Nix.
I laughed then. Of course, sorry.
At least until you settle somewhere with grass.
I stopped in my work, my arms full of laundry. Who says I'm going to settle? She shrugged.
Most people do.
You don't?
I did. But I have no cattle left now, metaphorical or otherwise. How would I marry? Besides, Iron gets jealous, she said with a wink.
Then she pulled another knot tight, and the rope snapped in her hand.
Ach, Iron! See?
Right, well, as for me, I said, there's no need for cattle, because there isn't going to be any settling. She snorted. Don't laugh at me.
I'm not laughing at you. Iron is laughing at you.
I yanked the last dress off the line. Iron should stop causing trouble.
I told her that, but does she listen?
Bee shook her head.
No one listens to Bee. Maybe you should ask your mother.
I swallowed. She doesn't speak to me like Iron speaks to you.
I'll tell the captain to ask her then.
I don't think she speaks to him either.
I think she probably does.
Bee made another firm knot in the net. Then maybe he also doesn't listen. Just then, Kashmir came up through the hatch, looking very dapper. Both B and I watched as he crossed the deck and knocked on the captain's door. After a moment, it opened. He went in, and both of us stopped breathing as we listened for shouting. But nothing came. B nodded.
Good thing he doesn't mind.
I glared at her. There's nothing to mind.
As you say.
I went below and dumped the laundry in my room. From the clean pile, I picked out a yellow cotton dress with a tiny floral print that fit much better than the pinafore. I yanked it over my head, still fuming. I didn't know why her assumptions annoyed me. It was only to be expected. I had spent the night in Kashmir's room. From the crew's perspective, the meaning there was clear, even if Kashmir and I had never so much as kissed. Though, for a moment last night, we might have. He was making a joke about something silly. I couldn't even remember what it was, because I had turned my head to reply when I found myself staring directly into his eyes, and he into mine. And in that moment, I saw the horizon unbounded, and I reeled with the vastness of it. What new shores would I discover if I could only travel those few inches? A storm, a tempest in the pit of my stomach. But I was the skiff tossed on the waves, and my father's lesson like thunder in my ears. Don't get too close. Still, the temptation was there. Cash must have realized it a second after I did. His eyes widened, but he did not lean in, nor did he turn away. He left it to me. B and Ian had nothing to laugh at. I was debating folding my laundry or finding some breakfast when there came a familiar howl through the porthole.
Woo! Woo!
I ran to the galley and found one forlorn chunk of sweetbread to bring topside. I leaned over the rail, ready to toss Billy the crust, and was surprised to see she wasn't alone. There, on the pier, were the boy and his chocolate mare.
Hello,
he said, doffing his hat.
Oh, wait!
The dog was already halfway up the gangplank by the time Blake Hart dismounted. He ran up after her as she rammed my legs, her whole body wiggling.
Sorry, he said, trying to pull her back. She followed me from Bertania. It seems she remembers the bun.
It's all right, Mr. Hart. The entire hunk of bread was snatched from my hand. I don't think I'm as hungry as she is.
Tantalus isn't as hungry as she is.
I laughed. Indeed. Welcome aboard. But what has brought you here?
Many thanks, he said, tipping his hat. Well, I... No!
He lunged for the dog, but she slipped his grasp. Slate had emerged from his cabin, followed by Kashmir, and Billy bounded across the deck to cozy up to them. The captain looked askance at the little beagle as she thumped his legs with her tail.
What is this? Billy!
Blake snapped his fingers. She lifted her nose from Kashmir's shoes. Blake pointed sternly to the pier, and she trotted off the ship to wait by his horse.
That's Billy. She took quite a liking to the young lady the other day. Did she?
Kashmir murmured, wiping his shoes with his silk handkerchief. Blake, Mr. Hart, I said, meet my father, Captain Slate.
Ah, the captain himself. Just the man I wanted to see.
He offered his hand heartily. I waited for it, the look back and forth between my father and me. But it didn't happen.
A fine man for a fine vessel. Blake Hart?
Slate took his hand.
The name is somewhat familiar. I don't think we've met, sir. I would recall. But it's a pleasure to do so now. And Mr. Theorus,
Kashmir said, folding his handkerchief neatly and making a crisp bow. Blake's brow furrowed as he took in the fine clothes.
A sailor? Her tutor,
Kashmir said smoothly. Blake cocked his head.
You're much younger than any of my tutors.
Bali, I am wise beyond my years, Kashmir said.
And, of course, I have a natural inclination to it. My people did, after all, invent algebra, including the zero.
He was smiling, too, but not with his eyes.
Blake Hart,
Slate said then, snapping his fingers and pointing at Blake.
But you're too young.
Blake looked at him quizzically.
Too young for... Maybe it was your father.
Slate nodded to himself. He stood close enough now. I could see the signs. His eyes dark, his brow shining, his reactions a touch too slow. I cut in. What can I do for you?
Well, Blake said carefully, speaking of my father, I'm here at his request to deliver an invitation.
He pulled a white card, the color of bleached coral, out of the breast pocket of his jacket. An invitation? From his father, who was hosting the ball. The brother of the mapmaker, then. I glanced at Kashmir, but he gave no sign of recognition. Then it occurred to me he might be doing that on purpose. I pretended to have a sudden, keen interest in my fingernails.
Yes, he asked me to say he'd be honored by your attendance at our little party. All of you.
Blake grinned at me.
As would I. Oh, I'm certain you would, Kashmir said. Thanks,
Slate said, fascinated with the card, tilting it and letting the gilt writing catch the light. Then he shoved it into his pocket.
Okay, let's go.
I winced as Slate started walking down the gangplank. Kashmir followed, though more slowly. Blake inclined his head, his expression still polite.
Good day, gentlemen.
Then he offered me his arm.
Allow me?
To what?
To help you down the gangplank.
Oh, I'm not going with them, I said, watching Cash and Slate cross the wharf toward town. Just two fine gentlemen on a stroll. I sighed. They're on business that doesn't involve me.
Is that so?
Blake raised his eyebrows.
Their loss.
He put his hands in his pockets and glanced at the mast, the sails, the wheel.
You know, I've never been aboard a ship before.
I couldn't help but grin when he jumped up and down a little on the deck.
I've been on canoes, the outriggers, the Hawaiians favor, but nothing that could cross the Pacific.
Mind giving me a tour? Unfortunately, I'd have to ask the captain.
Of course, of course.
He tapped his finger on his lips. Then he offered his arm again.
Well, if you're not otherwise occupied, allow me to make up for Billy's transgression against your breakfast. There's a cafe just up the street.
I hesitated a moment, wondering how proper it would seem to take Blake's offer, before throwing caution overboard and slipping my arm in his with a little thrill. Cash and Slate weren't the only ones who could reconnoiter. The map was hidden somewhere at Blake's house. If I could discover its hiding place, we might not need to wait for the ball. Chapter 16. Arm in arm as we were, the gangplank, being only wide enough for one, took a bit of negotiating. I didn't need Blake's steadying hand as I stepped onto the pier, but I took it anyway, marveling at his calluses, where he must have held the pen, so different than mine. Blake looped his horse's reins around his free hand, and we started up Fifth Street, Billy leaping at our heels like a dolphin in our wake. My mind was racing. I wanted to ask about his father's map, where it was kept, if it was authentic, if an original even existed. But how? What would he know, and what was safe to say? I couldn't imagine Blake, with his honest, open face, being part of a cabal. But Mr. D had been clear about the risk if we made any mention of our meeting.
I found Alexander Sutphen,
Blake said, interrupting my thoughts.
He's a drafter downtown, on Queen Street and Richards, second floor.
I blinked at him, and he smiled.
Well, I can't very well claim to be an expert if I can't answer your questions.
Thanks. Thank you. Although the information about Sutphen was useful, I was more concerned now with the other map. And now that he'd opened the topic...
"But I have one of my own," he continued before I could speak. "What's your name?"
I wondered, as always, whether to lie. But no, Mr. D already knew. "My name is Nix Song." He cocked his head.
"Nix? Interesting."
"Nix was a water sprite in Germanic myth," I said. "She lured men into the lake to drown. We have water spirits here, too, although they're shaped like lizards. Harder for them to lure men, then."
"Depends on the man, I suppose,"
he said, making me laugh. Then he hung his head in mock regret.
"Alas, I was only named after my uncle."
"The dead one?" I said too quickly. His smile faltered, and my mouth went dry in the ensuing silence. I beg your pardon. Clearly, I've been too long at sea."
"No, no," Blake said. "I never knew the man, although my mother tells me I take after him quite a bit."
The drunkard who mapped the opium dens? Thankfully, I kept that thought behind my teeth.
"How so?" "I have his artistic bent. My father can't draw a square on a grid. But how did you know about my uncle's death?"
I stumbled. He steadied my arm as I tried to think of an answer. The newspaper, I think it was."
"Must have been a very old newspaper," he said, looking at me sideways.
Yes, it was." I tried to think past all the curse words. "It wasn't the newspaper. I remember now. My father and yours are discussing a business venture, and he mentioned your uncle's misfortune."
"So you've met my father?"
"Well, no. It was a mutual friend who was making the introduction."
"Damn, damn, damn.
I don't know anything about their business," I added in an attempt to forestall any more questions.
"Something to do with the captain's excursion today, no doubt."
"Difficult to say," I said weakly. But he was smiling.
"Well, that's good news, especially if it means you'll be in Honolulu a while." "Ah, here we are."
He pulled me into Nolte's coffee saloon. Billy knew better than to follow. She wandered off after a departing patron holding a biscuit. Blake ordered coffee and scones, and we sat at one end of a long table occupied by a few other patrons. A young gentleman reading the paper, two sailors staring bleary-eyed into steaming cups, an old man warming his gnarled knuckles. Blake added enough cream to shade the brew the color of maple, while I took mine black and hot. I blew over the cup and then stopped, reminded of my father, and tried to gather my thoughts for a new attempt. "So, your uncle was an artist as well?"
"We have a great many of his paintings hung in the house. My mother admired his work. I can show you at the ball if you like."
"Oh, yes, I'd love to see."
"Are you a connoisseur of the arts?"
I laughed a little, remembering what Kashmir had said at Christie's. "No, I'm no expert." He gave me a quizzical look, and I cringed internally. I should have lied. Why else would I have sounded so eager a moment before? "I mean, I like art," I stammered. "I just don't know much about it."
"Well," he said with mock resignation, "I suppose that explains your kindness about my sketchbook."
"Not at all," I protested, hoping I wasn't blushing. "Your drawings really are lovely, especially the maps."
"I know about maps."
I ran my finger along the chipped edge of the saucer. I'd seen my opportunity come back again. "Did your uncle also draw maps, as you do?" He stirred his coffee.
"Not that I know of."
"Oh." I tried to keep the disappointment off my face. We both reached for our cups simultaneously. The silence felt long.
"You're very keen on maps,"
he said when he set his cup down. "Well, of course I am," I said quickly. "They're useful to a sailor."
"To an explorer, too."
He gave me that secret smile again, and I couldn't help but return it.
"So, not only an artist?" I said, teasing.
Do you hope to follow in the footsteps of Dr. Livingston?
And go to Africa? No. Hawaii has enough mystery to occupy a dozen Dr. Livingstons. At least for now, he added, his eyes darkening.
Nervous, I picked up my cup again. It clattered on the saucer. Times are changing?
That's one reason I record what I see. Things disappear otherwise.
Surprised, I looked up at him, my hands stilled. I've noticed that very same thing.
Have you?
He tilted his head, studying my face. But even under this scrutiny, I wasn't nervous anymore.
You must have seen a great many things in your travels, Miss Song. But having known nothing else, I can promise you this island is unique in all the world, and everything unique is worth preserving.
And worth seeing.
Yes.
I stared at him, and the thoughts of reconnoitering fell away. What might I learn if I spent even a day on the island, instead of mining for information on this damned map? But my smile faded, and I swirled the gritty dregs in the bottom of my cup. I never stay long enough to learn a place's secrets. He sat back. His eyes seemed to reflect my sadness. Then he nodded, as though making a decision.
Finish your coffee and come with me.
I pushed the mug aside as he stood. And where are we going? I asked, following him out the door.
Miss Song, he said, throwing a grin back over his shoulder. I'm going to show you your country.
An answering smile crept unbidden across my face. It fell away, though, at his next question.
Can you ride?
I stopped in my tracks. The horse seemed much more intimidating than she had an hour before. I don't know.
He laughed. Don't be nervous. I've named her Palikia, but she's quite gentle.
What's Palikia mean?
Trouble. More what we get into than what she gives me.
He paused, looking at the saddle. Western, with the high pommel and the big stirrups with leather guards to protect the rider's feet when going through thick brush. And then back at me, or rather at my skirt.
Will you be comfortable on the saddle? We can walk if you'd prefer.
No, I said firmly. We'll go farther on horseback. He knelt, cupping his palms down near my knees. I stepped into his hands and sprang onto the saddle, sitting with my legs both over Palikia's left side. I had a brief sensation of vertigo. The height was dizzying. But then Blake swung up behind me, steadying me with his arms on either side of my body.
"What would you like to see most?" he asked.
I considered all the places I'd been, most of them long gone. "Something I can only see here and now." Blake glanced up at the sun. It was high in the sky.
All right. We just barely have time.
He put his heels into Palikia's flanks, and we set off through town, traveling atop our shadow. It took me a few minutes to get used to the motion of the horse, so different from the rocking of the ship. As we passed by, Blake pointed out landmarks. Here, the Kamehameha post office, Hawaii's only connection to the world beyond the shore. There, a grassy square where the king gave free concerts on nights of the full moon.
He's even revived the hula, and they dance on the grass while the missionaries avert their eyes.
His lips were just behind my ear, as though it was a secret, and I heard the amusement in his voice. What do you mean, revived?
It had been banned for many years before Kalakaua took power.
Too licentious for past rulers?
It scandalized the foreigners, who only saw what they were looking for. The hula tells a story, but they weren't listening.
You admire the king?
You're surprised?
I bit my lip. Earlier, I had been nearly certain Mr. D had sent him to test me, but now I was not so sure.
Unless, of course, it was just a ruse.
Or perhaps this was only conversation, and my own involvement was making me paranoid.
He has his faults, Blake continued, but love of his own culture is not among them.
As we traveled south on King Street, a keening cry on the wind, like hungry gulls resolved into the high, sobbing song of professional mourners. The smell of thousands of cut flowers was carried toward us on the humid breeze.
Iolani Palace, Blake said.
I had guessed. The palace was draped in swathes of black bunting that hung over the wide windows. Beneath the somber trappings, Iolani Palace was a grand structure, two tall stories with four corner turrets, connected by wide verandas and lined with delicate columns. It's very European.
The king toured Europe before he had Iolani built. Some foreigners expected a hovel, so he spared no expense. That was going to be the palace over there, he said, pointing across the street to a smaller, though still lovely building across the street. The Ali Iolani Hali. But he put the government offices there instead.
Ah. I licked my lips. My mouth was dry. The treasury and so forth.
Yes.
Beyond the palace, we passed rich townhouses, including the black-draped windows of the home of the banker Mr. Bishop, Princess Powahi's widower.
This is the wealthiest block on the island, Blake said. Many of these families will be attending the ball, if you're interested in that sort of thing.
What sort of thing?
The comings and goings of high society.
I couldn't see his face, but in his voice, was it a hint of scorn? Oh, not generally. Then I frowned. Your father is an important man? Blake paused before answering.
He has important friends.
Traveling north away from the sea, we emerged into cooler air as we climbed out of the city. The shops gave way to the mansions and manicured gardens. The breeze shivered in the leaves of lush ferns by the side of the road.
This is Nuuanu Valley, he said.
I sat up straighter. My father once hoped to make a home here.
Why did he decide against it?
My mother died before he could.
Ah, is that why he took you to sea? If things had been but a little different, we would have been neighbors. That's our house there on the left.
I peered down a wide drive lined with chunks of coral that curved through an emerald green lawn, studded with flowering plants. Under a mantle of trailing vines, rioting with flowers, I caught glimpses of a boxy white Victorian house with a deep veranda, in front of which was parked an empty calash and a delivery wagon hitched to a sleepy mule. It struck me then, I might be able to learn exactly where the map was kept. Palikia leaned in toward the driveway, but Blake kept her on the road, pulling gently at the reins and, for a moment, bringing his arm close around my waist. Isn't your house included on this tour?
It's in a bit of a state, with the preparations for the party, he said apologetically. You'll see it soon enough. Just a moment.
He pulled the horse toward the opposite side of the road, where the trees drew in close.
There's a natural spring here, he said, dismounting and leading us into the trees.
It was only a dozen feet to the water, where Palikia dropped her head and drank deep. But once inside the forest, the greenery wrapped around us like a soft embrace, and I could no longer see the road.
The island is peppered with them. There's one farther up in the valley that the chieftains used to bathe in. Back then, commoners weren't allowed to touch the water due to its mystic healing properties, on pain of decapitation.
My ears perked. Is it true?
What part? The healing or the head chopping? He teased. They believed it, and that's what matters. I'm not going to risk it anyway. Wouldn't that be the worst way to cure a head cold? I have tried this spring, he continued, nodding toward the water at our feet. It won't heal so much as a paper cut, although the water's quite pure. Are you thirsty? Wait here.
He disappeared into the thicket in a direction I'd have assumed he'd picked at random, but for the certainty with which he went. The sound of his footsteps, muffled by the damp humus that lay like a down blanket on the earth, quickly faded, and for a few minutes, Palikia and I were alone in the forest. It was an odd feeling, the rich green life pressing close around me, hiding everything from view. So unlike the open sea. The burbling of the stream, the call of hidden birds, and the susurration of the wind in the treetops were no louder in my ears than the sound of my own breath. Then, as suddenly as Blake had gone, he returned, holding handfuls of mottled yellow fruits, each the size of my fist. He took a small knife from the saddlebag and sliced one in half, to reveal pink pulp studded with tiny yellow seeds. "Oh, guavas," I said. "I've only ever seen them green."
"Different species, I think."
He crouched near the water and rinsed the pulp from the rind, which he then filled with clear water and handed to me as though it were a teacup. The water was cool and sweet. After I drank my fill, he handed me another few guavas and I ate them whole, the rind giving way easily to the tart and tender flesh. Juice dripped down my chin, and he flicked out his handkerchief. "Mmm," I said, by way of thanks. Blake scratched the horse's neck and fed her a guava.
"They grow everywhere up here, along with several stands of excellent rose apples, bananas and mangoes as well."
"Who planted them?"
"The birds, the breeze. The garden Hawaii resembles most is Eden."
"Ah." I handed back his handkerchief. "My father feels the same way." He cocked his head.
"But how do you feel?"
I hesitated. "I'm not sure yet."
"Oh? I must work harder to convince you. Here."
He handed me the reins and swung himself up behind me.
"We've got to hurry a bit, but I'll show you my favorite spot on the island."
"I'm not pressed for time."
"Ah, but I can't bring you there near to dusk."
"Treacherous footing?"
"No, the Huakai Po."
I frowned.
"That sounds like it means trouble, too. Of a very certain sort. Haven't you heard of the Night Marchers? The Huakai Po are the spirits of the ancient warriors of Hawaii. All the locals know the story."
He leaned forward, his voice low in my ear. "Legend says they march all through this valley. When the warriors are walking, the first thing you hear is the sound of drums, far away, and someone blowing a conch shell. In the distance, you'll see their torches glowing in the dark. By the time you hear the sound of marching feet, you must throw yourself on the ground, face down, to show respect, but also to shield your eyes, because if you look at them directly, they'll take you, and you'll have to walk among them till the end of time." His breath tingled on the back of my neck. I shivered, and he laughed, low in his throat.
"Don't worry. I'll keep you safe."
We rode farther up into the rainforest of Nu'u'anu, leaving the houses behind and stepping onto a thin dirt track that wound through the tall rose-apple trees, studded here and there with enormous staghorn ferns, like fantastical brooches on the slender shoulders of society ladies. In the places where the path was steeper, he leaned forward to help Pilikia keep her footing. His chest was quite warm against my back. "Have you ever seen them?" I said. "The Night Marchers?"
"I've never found myself face down on the road surrounded by an army of ghosts, but I have sometimes seen torchlight on the mountainside. Who can say?"
"Fascinating.
Are you having fun with me?"
"Not at all. Myths reveal the history of a place. I mean, who are these warriors? What do they protect? Why do they wander? I know the Hawaiian chieftains never suffered commoners to look them in the eye. I read that once, but..." I stopped myself. I was gushing. "Well, I've never had a tour guide."
"I would gladly teach you all I know about the islands. I'd need some time, of course."
"A few weeks?"
"A few years."
I laughed. "Maybe I should just look over your sketchbook."
"Oh, Miss Song, it's so much more than what you could read in a book."
A red bird flitted across our path, and the trees opened up into a clearing where flowers winked from the edges of the undergrowth. The sun warmed the grass beneath Palikia's hooves, but the air was quite cool and as soft as a kiss. In the distance, rushing water whispered about where it had been. "Is this it?" I asked.
"Oh, no, we're not there yet. This is, well, you can see the places where the grass is growing a bit thinner. That's because the earth was packed down under the halipiri, the grass houses. There was a village here when I was a small boy. The signs are faint, though."
"Where did they go?"
"They died."
I gasped. "How?"
"Foreign disease. The least dramatic type of slaughter."
The path continued on the other side of the sunny clearing, but it had grown narrower and the trees lower. Green and yellow guavas hung from lichen-gray branches that wove themselves together at a height just above our heads. Blake stopped Palikia and swung down from her saddle. He offered me his hand.
"We have to continue on foot, but it's not much farther."
I took his hand and slid from the saddle. My shoes sank into the loamy earth. Blake removed his own shoes and socks. He grinned when he saw me watching.
"How do you think I keep them clean?"
He threw his jacket over the pommel of the saddle.
"Come."
I followed him along a path no wider than my feet, lined with feathery ferns and drooping pink ginger. He pushed ahead of me, through the branches, bending them out of my way. "What is this place?" I stepped under his arm as he held open a fall of vines like a curtain. The roar of water grew louder, and the fresh smell of crushed greenery filled my lungs.
"I told you before, it's a sacred place, a secret place, where the water comes out of the caves in a fall so powerful it turns to mist and drifts in clouds down into a healing pool. Please," he added with a grin, "try not to lure me in and drown me."
I smiled back at him. "Don't you know how to swim?"
"Miss Song, do you think I could have lived my life on an island and not learned how to swim?"
"Why is that a given? Do you want to escape?" He laughed and reached for me, helping me across a rocky patch of the trail, where orchids bloomed at my feet, and my father's words resurfaced.
"Heaven in a wildflower."
The path smoothed, but I didn't let go of Blake's hand.
"My mother talks of sending me to England to complete my education," he said. "But no, I don't want to leave."
"Why not?" I asked. And then I stopped dead in my tracks. We had emerged from the exuberant undergrowth into a large clearing where, as Blake had said, a silver spray of water burst from the cliff face 50 feet above our heads, enveloping the mossy black rocks in clouds of mist as it fell to shatter the mirror of the black pool at our feet.
"Why not?"
He turned to me, his face shining.
"This is paradise, Miss Song,"
he said, gesturing at the roaring falls.
"This is home."
Chapter 17. Blake dropped me off at the ship near dinner time. We hadn't had time to explore the caves above the falls, but Blake gave me his word he'd show me someday. Neither of us set a date, though. We knew the promise was empty. Despite the guavas, I heard his stomach growling on the ride back, and I hoped it was loud enough to mask the sound of my own. This close to the ship, I smelled Rotgut cooking fish stew, and I hesitated on the dock. I might have invited Blake up for a bowl if he were of another era and I'd had another upbringing. B was there on the deck, watching us impassively. Blake raised his hand to hail her, and she nodded without saying a word. His eyes sparkled as he leaned in to whisper,
"She is certainly a pirate."
"Not at all. She was a cattle herder."
"What? Like a Paniolo? A cowboy?"
"Cowgirl."
"Like Annie Oakley?"
"She's better with a revolver than a rifle."
"Who cut her throat? Was it cattle rustlers?"
"A man jealous of her. Her marriage, actually." How awful. Blake gazed at B. It's hard to comprehend all the evil committed in the name of love. Or greed, I said, remembering Kashmir and Slate and the business I'd mostly forgotten all afternoon. I took a step back, toward the ship, suddenly anxious not to have Kashmir come up on deck and see us together. Good night, Mr. Hart.
Until the full moon, Miss Song.
He tipped his hat to me, as though ready to leave, but he did not go.
I would like to ask, he said after a moment, I would be honored if you would attend as my personal guest.
Oh?
Oh.
Oh, I was attending with, my tutor, actually, I finished lamely. Puzzlement flickered across Blake's face. It was a terribly unbelievable story for the time. He is also my dancing instructor, I extemporized.
Do you dance much on the ship, then?
Ah, well, you must have heard that dancing is a cure for seasickness.
Odd, he said. A sailor who gets seasick?
I laughed a little. What else could I do? Well, he continued, dropping the point.
Perhaps he would prefer to have the evening off. There are many events in Honolulu that night.
I know he is eager to attend the ball.
Ah, then I will be pleased to see the both of you there, he said,
but he seemed less pleased than he had a moment before. He tipped his hat again.
Good night, then, Miss Song.
He turned Palikia toward home. Her ears swiveled forward, and she broke into a trot with little urging. I climbed up the gangplank. Here, on the deck of the ship, I was once more on firm footing. I met B's eyes. He doesn't have any cattle either, I told her, and she laughed. Kashmir and Slate had not yet returned, so I needn't have worried about being seen, though I could have been worrying about where they were. But I was too hungry to worry. I ate so fast I barely tasted my dinner, outpacing even Rotgut, although that may have been because he was telling me about the rock lobsters he'd caught on the reef, while I was focused more single-mindedly on consuming them. It was only shortly after I finished my bowl that I heard Cash and Slate tramping across the deck above my head. After a moment of consideration, I made up two conciliatory bowls of stew and carried them topside. I found them together, their heads close. The captain's face was drawn, and though they spoke in low tones, his gestures were emphatic, and he broke off abruptly when he saw me approach. Kashmir accepted the bowl gratefully, but Slate just shook his head. It had been years since I'd last bothered trying to insist. I dug into the stew myself, more slowly this time. It was very good, huge chunks of white lobster and a broth rich with butter. Rotgut loved to eat well, and it showed in his cooking. "So," I asked, "how did it go? On a scale of 1 to treason?" Kashmir barked a laugh. But Slate waved a dismissive hand. I pursed my lips. "I was worried about you," I said to my father. He didn't respond. "Worried you'd get shot." He folded his arms and glared off toward the blackness of the open sea.
"We weren't shot."
"Yes, indeed, I see that now."
"Thank you for your concern," he said, stalking off to his room.
"You know, we'd be stuck here if you died," I called after him. He paused with his hand on the doorknob.
"You wouldn't be stuck,"
he said, seeming to speak to the teak of the door.
"You would find a way, Nixie, if you really wanted to escape."
He shut the door behind him, and Blake's words came back to me.
"Why would I? This is home."
I shook them out of my head and slid down to sit against the bulwark, setting my half-empty bowl on my knees, suddenly uncomfortably full.
"Ugh, today put him in a foul mood,"
Kashmir said. "I put him in a foul mood," I corrected, leaving myself wide open, but Cash didn't even seem to notice.
"Then today made it worse."
He tipped his own bowl and scraped the bottom with his spoon. Then he sat beside me and took my bowl from my hands. What happened? He made a face.
Do you really want to know?
Yeah, shoot.
Ha ha. Well, we've encountered a few obstacles. The biggest one, the weight of the gold. There's no way to carry it away without help, or at least a couple of draft horses. There's also the Royal Hawaiian Guard to consider. It's only 50 local boys in nice uniforms, but all it takes is one lucky shot. Slate was talking about hiring mercenaries, but...
Ugh, not really. Kashmir shrugged.
He didn't seem happy about it.
Where would he find them? The map ends 100 miles out to sea. How would we get back here? And can you imagine having mercenaries aboard? Or, God, unleashing them here?
I don't know, Amira. It's a last resort. He doesn't want any bloodshed.
Well, then he shouldn't be considering piracy.
Do you have any better ideas?
I scoffed. If I did, I wouldn't share them with the captain.
Pourquoi pas?
He said.
It will never actually happen. You and I will get the map first. But in the meantime, you could get back in his good graces if you would just promise to try to help him.
I made a face. That's dishonest.
Heaven forfend you lie so you can steal. He's thinking of giving you the evening watch on the night of the ball.
My jaw dropped, and Kashmir shrugged.
I told you, he's in a foul mood.
But I have to be there.
I'm sure I can manage without you, Amira.
No, I mean, I'm expected. It felt like a confession. Mr. Hart asked me to come.
He asked all of us to come.
No, I mean, he asked again later, after the hike. Kashmir's spoon stopped in midair.
After the what?
I was trying to reconnoiter like you, only I didn't have much success.
You were trying...
His brow furrowed like he was trying to picture it. Amira,
what exactly did you say to him? Tell me you didn't tip our hand.
I don't think so. We did talk about maps, but it was a part of a previous conversation.
You mentioned the map? The map we want to steal? The map his father is using to barter for treason?
It wasn't like that, and he might not be on their side at any rate. When we were at the waterfall, he was going on about paradise. I trailed off. Kashmir was shaking his head as though in awe. My cheeks went hot.
Next time, Amira, he said at last, leave the reconnoitering to me.
Understood. I dropped my chin, letting my hair fall over my face. We were quiet for a while as he scraped the bottom of his bowl with the spoon.
You'd met the boy before?
In Chinatown, yes.
By luck or by design, do you think?
Oh, luck, definitely. He arched one eyebrow.
His or yours?
I cocked my head at him. Kashmir, are you jealous? I teased. He didn't laugh, though. His expression didn't change at all. An odd fluttering flew into my throat, and I swallowed it down. What, do you think he's in on the plot?
Oh, no, nothing so grand. But there's more than one reason to spy on a pretty girl.
Kashmir stood up, taking the bowls. Then he flashed me his teeth.
I told you you looked like a hussy.
Takes one to know one, I called as he went below. But my heart wasn't in it. And that night when I changed clothes, I found myself staring into the mirror and wondering what Blake saw when he looked at me. Chapter 18. The next few days were busy. The captain had accepted my offer of help with a huge grin and a bear hug, but it left a sour taste in my mouth, and not only because it went against what I had told him before. Ever since the hike, Mr. D's request had seemed particularly odious. But Slade and Kashmir were away from the ship for long hours of the day and night, and the captain didn't have time to ask me whether or not I'd made any progress on the challenges inherent in the theft. I ended up having to pitch in on his watches, which we'd started keeping strictly since Mr. D's visit. But instead of studying the maps, I spent my time reading the paper. The majority of the articles were depressing items about Princess Powahi, evincing the Victorian obsession with death. Her funeral was to be held on the 2nd of November. Her husband was sick with grief. But alongside those morbid tidbits, other stories stood out. The king had been busy of late. Aside from the funeral of his cousin, he'd been planning a jubilee to commemorate Hawaii's Independence Day, the anniversary of the day the Kingdom of Hawaii was recognized as a sovereign nation by the crowned heads of Europe. The celebration would begin on November 28 and continue through the weekend, and would feature performances of the scandalous hula and concerts by the Royal Hawaiian Band. There would also be a parade and fireworks, suitable for a nation 20 times the size of Hawaii, the paper noted in what seemed to me like a sniffy tone. Kalakaua was also dealing with a bill proposing to return to the practice of issuing opium licenses, so proprietors might sell the drug. It was offered as a way to raise revenue, but the king declined in fear of the effect it might have on his beleaguered people, some of whom already struggled with alcohol. Auntie Joss might prefer the bill ratified, and Kalakaua might have to do it, were he to find the treasury in deficit. But when I read two more mentions in the paper, one, the census reporting that, although the native population was in decline, the overall population of the islands was growing, and the other, an anonymous letter to the editor calling for a closer alliance with America, I saw the political landscape come into view. Kalakaua's kingdom was being overwhelmed by foreign interests. I gathered this intelligence, but I had no one to tell. Kashmir disappeared with Slate every morning to go into town and returned only late at night, spending the days before the ball preparing to give Mr. D his answer. But I too had preparations to make. So on Thursday afternoon, I managed to finish my chores early and wheedle B into giving me a few hours of freedom so I could stop by to visit the Mercier sisters. They were pleased to see me, although perhaps less pleased than they might have been to see both me and Kashmir. Emily asked after him as she fussed with the bustle on the dress. "He's in town, doing errands." I watched our reflection in the long oval mirror. I did not look like myself. "He's very dashing," Emily said, "and quite young. Is he really your tutor?" Nan's eyes cut to her sister. She made a small noise of protest at the question, but her mouth was full of pins. "Yes," I said airily. "Did you know his people invented the zero?" The jacket needed to be taken in at the waist, but the dress fit perfectly. I paid the remainder of the balance and asked that they have everything delivered to the ship when they were finished. In the rich silks and ribbons, would I pass for a society girl among Blake's father's important friends? On the way back to the ship, I crossed Queen Street. Remembering the conversation I'd had with Blake, I took a detour south to Richards. I walked up and down the block twice before I saw it. There, on the second floor windows of a white stucco building, the gold lettering on the glass, A. Sutphin and Company, since 1877. The door was unlocked, so I showed myself in, up the narrow stairs to a lived-in studio with a checked oak floor, well lit by southern windows and gas jets. The walls of this front room, obviously a converted parlor, were lined with wide, deep shelves, each holding a single sheet of paper, maps in their various stages of completion. There was a drafting desk by the windows where a man, perhaps 30 years old, although already starting to bald, sat drawing. I knocked on the half-open door, and he started at the sound, his gold-wire spectacles slipping down his nose. He thumbed them up in a peculiar gesture.
"Oh, hello. How do you do?
He peered at me closely. I was probably not one of his typical visitors.
How may I help you, miss?
Mr. Sutphin, you make maps?
Oh, yes.
He said, gesturing toward the shelves on the wall, as if to prove it.